And all the Al-Qaeda leaders who have been arrested not in Afghanistan, but traveling in other parts of the world, and largely through normal police activity. Police work, detective work, and caught, and imprisoned, and tried. And that is the way to dismantle a group which you think has committed damage. If you punish an entire population for what has been done by a tiny handful of people, then it increases the flow of recruits to these organizations. And that is a point that many of us made. And actually, Obama spelt that out in relation to Iraq well when he said to McCain, Al-Qaeda was not present in Iraq before we went in there, now it is. Absolutely right. The only country in the world where people believed that Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein had close links was the United States. The rest of the world just laughed at this propaganda. So in relation to Afghanistan, you had a decision taken to occupy the country and remove the government. Okay. You couldn't have done that without the support of the Pakistani regime. How? Because the Taliban regime, which was in power at that time, had close links to Pakistan. And the Pakistani military and intelligence apparatuses said to them, it's crazy to resist, don't fight back. And so Kabul fell without a single person dying. Pakistan did that for the United States. So one can't claim, as some people are doing, that that Pakistan is not being helpful. It's been very helpful. And for being so helpful, Musharraf, the then leader, almost lost his life. There's three assassination attempts on him, two of which came very close to killing him. So there's got to be a sense of proportion in what is being said about what Pakistan has done or hasn't done. The fact is that the group of people implanted in Kabul by the United States, Hamid Karzai, his brother, his cousins, his cronies, had no idea what they were going to do in a country where they had very little support. So what they started to do was to grow rich, make money. And you read in US intelligence estimates and reports, they say they spell this out very clearly now, that one of the big problems in Afghanistan is the endemic corruption of the regime. So that these guys were grabbing land in the heart of Kabul, which used to be a very beautiful city in the old days, in the heart of Kabul, taking it, building large villas, protected by NATO troops, in a country where millions of people were homeless, and where to just construct a dwelling, a basic, simple dwelling that could house a family of six or seven or eight cost $10,000. That's all in local currency. Should have been done, could have been done, but wasn't done. And this group of people running Afghanistan on behalf of the United States allowed matters to get worse and worse and worse. More and more people then joined the groups fighting them. This word Taliban has now become, in my opinion, antiquated. And the British intelligence networks refer to it as the neo-Taliban. Because they say so many new people have joined them because they are the only people who are fighting and offering something, that their character has changed. And today I read on the web in the Observer that both the United States and the British spokesman have said that they are now going to enter into negotiations with the neo-Taliban because they can't run the country without them. So what is then all this talk about crossing the Pakistani border and violating Pakistani sovereignty? It's foolish talk. It's foolish talk. Al-Qaeda, the big, you know, the thing is this. Al-Qaeda is a group, not so large, which has operated out of different parts of the world. The bulk of its leaders come from the countries closest to the United States in the Arab world, Saudi Arabia and Egypt. These are the countries where these guys have been incubated. They were initially sent to Afghanistan to fight against the Russians. And at that time, as you all know, I hope you know, they were backed solidly by the United States. All the catechisms and primers being produced for the religious schools in northwestern Pakistan were being published by the University of Nebraska. The Afghan Studies Department. That's what was going on at that time. And some of us warned even at that time. I remember writing saying, you are sowing dragon seeds in this region. And that is exactly what's happened. And so one has to repeat again today to the United States government, don't go into Pakistan foolishly. Don't go in and kill innocent people, which is what you've been doing. Because the last two hits inside Pakistan have led to the death of women and children, casualties. And then you hit those people, there's a strong culture of revenge in that part of the world, and for many of them they say it's a fight to the death now. And they hit out, and they take their revenge. So instead, one has to find a way of ending the cycle of violence. And you can't end that as long as NATO is occupying a whole country. Very difficult to do that. And as I keep saying when I visit the United States, please try and understand one thing. It's a very simple thing to understand, that most people in most countries of the world don't like being occupied. They just don't like it. Different reasons, but it unites people. Even people who are very pro the United States politically don't like being occupied by the United States. And many of their own supporters in this part of the world appeal to them not to behave in the fashion that they're doing. So the war in Afghanistan has, because of what I pointed out to you, has created more and more opposition to the people running that country. The US soldiers sent into battle depend more and more on bombers. Big Daddy, they call the US Air Force, come and help us, Big Daddy. And Big Daddy goes above the villages and drops bombs. If you read Liz Rubin's reports in the New York Times some months ago, they spell it out. They're not trusted. No one likes foreigners in that part of the world, especially foreigners who are occupying their country. And we now have information, again published in the media, certainly in Europe, that that most of the officials, low-level officials, high-level officials, people who claim to be working with the NATO during the day, when the offices close, it becomes very clear that they have no support at all, no sympathy at all for NATO, and actually are going and working with those fighting against NATO. And when that happens in a country, there is no possible way you can win. You can kill more people, but you can't win in the long run. So what is needed in Afghanistan is not an extension of the war, not an expansion of the war into Pakistan, but an exit strategy from Afghanistan itself. If the only reason to stay in Afghanistan, as Barack Obama hinted, was that Al-Qaeda are still there, or are in Pakistan, and they had to be taken out, and Osama bin Laden was there, and this obsession with Osama bin Laden is, I find this really weird, actually. He's one guy. You know, I mean, it's obsession. He's become sort of the symbol of global evil. But what if he were dead? He may well be dead. A number of senior Pakistani leaders think he's dead. I've not seen him on a video for a very long time. So if he is still alive, we'll find out soon, because he normally makes an appearance during the US presidential elections. And sends a message to the US people as to who they should vote for. Could he be backing McCain? I don't know. But I really don't know, and very few people know, whether he's alive or dead. If US intelligence sources think he's alive and holed up somewhere, they've been there now. I mean, the US troops have been in that country for 7 years. Why don't they say, this is where he is, let's go tell the Pakistanis, go there and find him. But I think it almost serves the interests of all sides concerned not to worry too much whether he's there or not there, or whether he's dead or alive, so he can just be used. Used by the Pakistani military, because they've been getting a lot of aid, 10 billion and more since 9/11. Used by the United States to build up this big bogeyman, who with this group of 2,000 people, as if they could seriously threaten anyone. They have the capacity to make mischief and do mischief and carry out hits. But, you know, then so do many other people who have done so. In the weather people during the 60s used to do that. And remember the case in Oklahoma, the guy who blew up the building. Very interesting. I was thinking of that the other day. That the guy who blew up the Oklahoma State Building, the first reports in the media said dark-skinned, strange-looking people of Arab appearance. What more do you want? You know, the Kurd Muslims have been seen in the area, and one of them was seen rushing away from the burning building. And, you know, a wave of panic must have gone through American Muslims, saying, oh God, let's hope it's not someone like that. And mercifully it wasn't. And then the entire creation, deliberate creation of panic completely disappeared. It wasn't. It was really someone who'd fought in the US Army. And, you know, tough-minded guy, he decided to go up and blow this building. So the point I'm trying to make is that terrorism is not inherent in either Islam or any other religion. People from all religions and no religions do it. And the question is, how do you deal with it? Look, when the IRA in Ireland, what should we call them? Catholic terrorists? No one ever used to. But you know, if we want to be equal, that's what we should call them. I just call them the IRA, when they decided to blow up the entire British cabinet, including Margaret Thatcher, at the big hotel in Brighton and came close to doing it, what was the response of the British? After all, their most popular prime minister could have gone up in smoke. Popular, that is, within the establishment. She could have gone up in smoke. What did the British do? Did they go and bomb Derry? Did they send drones over to hit the Irish Republic? Because that's where these people came from. It was known, the Catholic areas of Ireland. No. Within 6 weeks of that event happening, they had opened private contacts with Sinn Féin leaders and started mapping out a strategy of disengagement and seeing when a ceasefire could come into play. That's when it started. And that is why, and you know, people say when you say this, I said it at DC once at a seminar, and someone stood up and said, yeah, but the IRA had a plan. They wanted the British to get out of Ireland. So there's something to discuss. These guys are just crazy. Well, I mean, you know, whether or not they're crazy is something for doctors to determine. But they certainly, we know what their demands are. They spell them out. I mean, if you look at Bin Laden's speeches, which have been published now, with an introduction by Bruce Lawrence, professor of religion at Duke, it's very clear what the guy says. He says we don't like the American military presence in our part of the world. So there is something to discuss, if it is discussable. But instead of at least attempting to discuss these issues, more wars take place. The war in Iraq, a disaster. And then the war, continuing war in Afghanistan. So there are two wars now, and talk of expanding it into 2.5 by entering the northwest frontier provinces of Pakistan isn't going to help anything. If people want to know what could be helpful in Pakistan, I'll spell it out. Pakistan is the sixth largest country in the world. It has a population approaching 200 million. It is a state in which the elite, which runs that state, the political classes, and the ultra-rich people in that country, and the military elite, have done virtually nothing for the last 60 years to improve the living conditions of most of their people. When I was researching this book on Pakistan, I discovered a statistic just recently which shocked me. Normally nothing shocks me about that part of the world. This did shock me. It's the UN Development Statistics, UNDP report, which said that 60% of children born in Pakistan are being born stunted because of malnutrition. 60% is an incredibly high figure. So the height of the average Pakistani citizen is coming down. The trend in the world since the Middle Ages has been the opposite, but in Pakistan, we are reverting to that. Now, this isn't normal, this is not God's will. This is not the fault of Islam. This is the fault of those people running the country and those who back them mindlessly and thoughtlessly, who have done nothing for their people. The price of wheat has risen to such heights. One reason, one, but not the only one, because the wheat has been smuggled into Afghanistan to feed the foreign armies. Massive demand for it. So people are starving. Many people are finding different forms of grasses to cook and make into cakes to eat. That's the real problem in Pakistan. The other problem is the education system. It doesn't exist. Unless you're well off. Unless you're very well off or reasonably well off or have access to some funds. And even here, the ideas which are embedded in the minds of various people who run that education, the rich education system in the country, are so backward that I think I can't think of many other countries in which that applies. It's sort of a it's class prejudice of the most primitive sort. And let me explain this to you by telling you a story. There is someone I know in the city of Lahore, a reasonably wealthy guy who makes furniture. His father made furniture. It's an old family furniture firm. He has a chauffeur who works for him, and he hasn't any children of his own, and he noticed that the chauffeur's daughter was a very bright, sparky 6-year-old. And he asked the chauffeur, where is she going to school? And the chauffeur said, she isn't. Because apart from anything else, she wasn't even a boy, she was a girl. So she wasn't going to school. So he got very angry and said, you should educate her. And he said, I can't afford to. So he said, I'll pay for you to educate your daughter. And the chauffeur said, and he then thought if he gave him money, he still wouldn't do it. So he got the girl dressed in very fine clothes. They went and bought the clothes. Rang up one of the best schools in the city. Of course, they all know him. And said, I want to, a young, child. I want to put her name down for this school. And they assumed, of course, that it must be a relation of his. So they said, fine, come. So he went and said, here's the girl. I'll give you a check for 6-7 years so you don't have to bother me every month. They said, fine. And then they said, what's the name of the child? So he gave it, and she had a different surname. So they said, oh, she isn't your daughter. He said, no. So they said, do you mind us asking whose daughter she is? He said, she's my chauffeur's daughter. They said, sorry, we can't take her into the school. Just like that. So what did he do? He took her to a convent. There's still a few convents and schools left, which was set up many years ago. Went to the nuns. They said, yeah, we'll have her with pleasure. Fine. He said, I'll give you some money. They said, we don't even want the money. But he did. He built them a science laboratory. That's how pleased he was with them. Now, when you have this mentality, which is quite, which reflects the mentality of this elite, which lives in a bubble of its own, doesn't think about the lives of ordinary people, all they think is about competing with each other in terms of who can spend more money on a family wedding. I'm not kidding. This competition in Pakistani cities is obscene. Can we have acres of land with special things? There's one wedding which took place recently where they recreated the court at Versailles with mirrors and everything, not even seeing the symbolic significance that is what triggered off the French Revolution, the lifestyle of the rich in 18th century France. That's what they do. And they fly food. Pakistan is a country with absolutely wonderful food, as most of you know. No one can compete really with our cooks and families who cook food, but that's not sufficient for these nouveau riches. They fly food in from Dubai. It comes on planes. Then they show, our food came from Dubai. The others say, no, our food came from a very good French restaurant in Qatar. So all these places in the Gulf themselves very artificial creations, sort of overbuilt imperial petrol stations. This is the place from where they get their food. And I'm trying to give you a picture of this country. Now, when I was writing this book, I traveled all over, literally. I went. And often I would go and talk to people. I had no idea who they were, but I just wanted to talk to them, ordinary people, fisher folk in Karachi, poor people in the heart of Lahore. And I would just sit with them and say, look, you don't know me, it doesn't matter. I just want to know what you really want out of life. If you had wishes that could be fulfilled, what would they be? And I promise you that the overwhelming majority of them said, we want our children to be educated. We want running water. We want cheap electricity. We just want a better existence. Some of them said, and we don't just want our children to be educated, we want them to be able to learn English, to break the monopoly of the use of English by the elite in that country. This is what, so they have the possibility of reading books, of studying abroad. This is not just a privilege of the few. And you know, by the end of it, I was almost in tears, because these are such simple, basic demands which can be satisfied. These are not utopian demands. Nothing of what they demanded was impossible. And in neighboring Malaysia, or not neighboring, but in Malaysia, in the same part of the world, virtually everyone now is literate. And more than that, everyone speaks Malay and Chinese and English. And when I was in Malaysia, I asked Dr. Mahathir, who was then the Prime Minister, I said, you know, I'm just astonished. The last time I came, it was very different. How did you do this? He said, simple. 30 years ago, we took a decision. Every school, and we spend a lot of money on education, must have English as a compulsory second language. So your first language could be Chinese or Malay. You have to know English. Because he said, we know that without knowing this language, our kids can't, you know, get the best of medicine, technology, anything. We can't translate every single thing into our language. So Malaysia can do it, but not Pakistan. So when people tell me that the big problem with Pakistan is jihadi extremists on the verge of taking over Pakistan's nuclear facility, I just burst out laughing. I said, that is impossible, and I'll tell you why it's impossible. Because the Pakistani military is 500,000 strong, because the nuclear facility is the most heavily guarded facility in the country, like it is in every nuclear state, and there's no group of jihadis, however strong, who could even penetrate that region or come close to it. The army would defend it like anything. So people say it can't happen. I said, no, it can't happen unless the Pakistani army, for whatever reason, wants it to happen. And I said, you go into that part of the world and then all bets are off. Who knows what will happen, because you will split the unity of the army, because half the army will say we can't tolerate what is happening, discard their uniforms and fight, and then I don't know what's going to happen. So these are the obsessions, you know, because most people making policy in the United States look at a country and the gaze is an imperial gaze. They see what their needs are in that country, not what the country's needs are. I mean, we don't want a war expanded and taken into Pakistan with innocents killed, because apart from all the other disastrous side effects, it will send lots of young people into the direction of violence. They'll say, we will now fight. we've got no other option left. And then you begin to wreck the social fabric of yet another country, a country where the social fabric is already extremely weak. And that is something which needs to be stopped. What Pakistan needs most today is not more weapons, not more wars. It needs to set up 10 or 12 teachers' training universities to train teachers properly to teach. That's what we need. You know, people get very worked up saying, look at the madrasas, the religious schools. But you know, if you have a situation where there's no state education system worth talking about, and a cleric goes to a poor villager who has 6 or 7 kids and says, give me one of your kids, we'll educate them, we'll clothe them, we'll feed them, and we'll return them to you fully educated, or whatever they say. The Jesuits used to say, give me your son at 7 and I will show you the man. And lots of people gave the Jesuits their kids to go and train, and these guys do similar things. The tragedy is that while the Jesuits did provide a proper education, the madrasas don't. But the reason lots of people allow one kid to go to that is because it's a burden off their shoulders. If there was a proper state education system, this would not happen. And there are good people, small groups of people who know this very well. And I know for a fact that in parts of the United States, Pakistani doctors, Pakistani businessmen are trying to help, which is good. Money is sent to some organizations to set up schools to educate girls, and this has happened in parts of the country. Girls have been educated, including in the areas considered the most socially conservative and religious areas, like Swat. It has happened. And if it can happen on this small level, why can't it happen on a larger level? So these are the problems confronting Pakistan today. The subtitle of my book, and the duel, let me explain to you the two titles of the book. The duel, which people might assume, is a duel between Pakistan and the United States, which many people here assume, but I explain in the very first pages of the book, it's not that. The duel is a duel between the majority of the population of Pakistan and those who rule them, and those who back the rulers, and it's not a violent duel. It's just a battle in the mind, on the streets sometimes, between these two. One who want to preserve their privileges, and the others who are desperate for something. The subtitle of the book is Pakistan on the Flight Path of American Power. And that is the story which surprised me, even as I was researching it, of how right from the beginning, the people who had won independence, the bulk of them were so used, because most of the leaders of the Muslim League, not all of them, but most of them had spent large parts of their lives and their fathers before them collaborating with the British Empire. And you know, if you become collaborators with an empire, you don't have to think because you get your orders from elsewhere. It's not been good, that process. That you work, the imperial bureaucracy tells you what you have to do, what you have to say, and you go and do it and say it. And you think, you know, because you have their support, you're strong and powerful. So when Pakistan became independent, many of these guys didn't know what they were going to do since they had no new masters. And the British were leaving. So within the first 4 years, they went in pursuit of new masters. I have discovered letters from senior members of the Pakistani establishment to the United States which are so shameful as to be embarrassing, saying, please come and take us. You can buy our army. This is how much we want. You can have us. We are yours for the asking. And for the first few years, the United States resisted because they were more interested in India. Then as the Cold War began to grow and develop, they said, okay, and they embroiled Pakistan in a network of security pacts. And there was opposition from below and opposition from politicians, some politicians and new parties emerging. And in order to prevent a general election from taking place that might challenge Pakistan's alliances, they encouraged the military to carry out a coup d'etat. So the cycle of military dictatorships began, totally backed by the United States. And they got the dictator they wanted, depending on what their needs were. Ayub Khan, Pakistan's first dictator, was not a deeply religious man. That was not the need of the moment, at that particular moment. Later on, they've got General Zia-ul-Haq, who was needed to fight the jihad against the Russians in Afghanistan. He called himself a soldier of Islam. Then the last one was a dictatorship in a time of neoliberal economics and the market, dominance of the market. And Pervez Musharraf said, I am a chief executive. Treat me as a chief executive. Well, thank God he isn't a chief executive at the moment, given what's happening in Wall Street. So the links between the US and Pakistan's military dictators disrupted the development of an organic political system in that country. And that is what we are suffering from today. I personally find it quite shameful that our new president is only there because his late wife was assassinated. That's the only reason this guy is president. No one trusts him, no one likes him. He is well known as one of the most corrupt politicians in Pakistan, corrupt people, because it's a slight exaggeration to call him a politician. Milked the country, looted the country, our politicians, when they came to power. He built a massive fortune when his wife was prime minister on two occasions before, just shamelessly. His properties and wealth litter all the continents. I'm told that George W. has helped him find a farm in Texas, though we haven't been able to locate it. So, with these people in charge, you know, it's sort of desperate times for the country. And then Benazir foolishly leaves behind a will, if it is her will, there some people doubt it, bequeathing her political party to her son, aged 18, until he comes of age, to his father. But you know, a political party is not a piece of property or land that you can pass on, or a piece of jewelry bought in Tiffany's, in which Zardari used to specialize as well. Shukr. That's a tragedy for us, that a political party is being done in this way. And the bigger tragedy is that they are good people, senior people in that party accept it. That angers me even more, that these people want to do it is one thing, but that people in that party accept it. So it's not when I criticize the military, which I do sometimes very sharply, it's not that the political class that we have are people from whom one can expect anything. That is the problem Pakistan confronts at the present moment today. And the surprise really is that not more Pakistanis go in the direction of jihadi terrorism. They don't. And the reason for that is also very interesting, is that traditionally, in the part of the country, well, in what is now Pakistan, in the countryside in Punjab, Sindh, Balochistan, and even the frontier province, the form of Islam that was practiced was very soft. It was largely Sufi Islam, the tradition for most people. The people who are worshipped to this day are the Sufi saints and Sufi poets. And I give you one example just for you to judge yourselves. When the Musharraf government, the last government in Pakistan, decided to attack the Red Mosque in Islamabad, let's leave aside why they had allowed it to become a center of arms and all that. Let's leave. They attacked the mosque. They killed people, which they shouldn't have done, but they did. They killed people and cleared the mosque. Every foreign commentator was saying, Pakistan is about to explode. This now is the end. They've done this, they've had it. I said, no, I don't think so. I think some people will be angry. But Pakistan is not going to explode because of this. What happened? There was one demonstration in Peshawar, attended by 1,500 people. That's the largest figure in the press, saying this shouldn't have happened. That's all. Nothing else happened. That same day, the 1,500 people were marching in Peshawar. You had in Kasur, in the Punjab, the anniversary of one of the greatest Sufi poets of Pakistan, Baba Waris Shah. 30,000 people turned up to pay homage and tribute and sing his songs. Now, those of us who know the country, therefore, are only too aware of what the real problems are and what the problems are not. Is there a problem with the armed groups in the frontier province? Without any doubt. In my opinion, these problems are linked to 30 years of war in Afghanistan. This war in Afghanistan has been going on for 30 years. Think about it. Longer than the First World War. Longer than the Second World War. First, the Russians. Then the Russians were kicked out. Then a small civil war. Then the Taliban come in with the help of the Pakistanis and take over the country. Then for a small period there's some stability. Then 9/11, a new occupation, and the war goes on. Now why this affects Pakistan, for those of you who don't know, is that people who live on both sides of the border, Afghan-Pakistan border, are the Pashtun people who have lived there for centuries, thousands of years. They speak the same language. They share the same culture, the same religion. They intermarry. The British imposed a border in 1891 just to say this is the border of the British Empire and you can't, this is our border. After fighting two wars in Afghanistan in which they were defeated in the 19th century. So they imposed the border. They could never police the border and never even try it, and it was obvious that the Pashtun people were allowed to cross the border whenever they wished. This was the position also of Pakistani governments till recently, till the war against the Russians when the border was stopped. So you cannot, it's very difficult to seal off northwestern Pakistan from what is happening in Afghanistan because the two peoples on each side are very close. And that is what is creating the mayhem. So I return to what I said earlier. We need an exit strategy for Afghanistan. Now what could this be? The West, believe it or not, would like the Taliban to come into Hamid Karzai's coalition government and use the Pakistanis to try and stabilize the situation. That's what they would like. The neo-Taliban have said we can't join Karzai, he's a discredited puppet, and we cannot join any coalition government as long as foreign troops are there. Okay. But in my opinion, this is not necessarily the correct solution which the West is in search of. It might defend their interests as they see fit. But Afghanistan is a mosaic. It's a mosaic. You have the Hazara people. You have the Central Asian people in the north. And the only way we can stabilize Afghanistan over the next 10 years, once NATO leaves, is to bring in regional powers with strong support inside Afghanistan to create a national government which is supported for 10 years and whose stability is guaranteed by these regional powers. Who are these regional powers? Pakistan, obviously, Iran, Russia, three key powers, and to put more pressure on creating a stable government, China and India. If these regional powers came in and backed a government for 10 years, and I'm convinced they would if approaches were made, then you would have a period of peace in that country, which they need. 10 years of peace, 10 years of social reconstruction, and you will see the jihadi terrorism, which is the big obsession of the West, would disappear. It would slow down to a trickle, if it existed at all, inside Pakistan. That is the way out. You know, the way out is not to wage more wars, because Pakistan has suffered enough. Its people, not its elites, its people have suffered enough by being on the flight path of American power from the 1950s till now. So the plea is, please take us off your flight path. Thank you.